Okay, so good morning. So I'm going to talk to you about the acidians again. So I guess you have a very unusual density of acidian talks in a meeting, but I hope that combined with what Ed was saying yesterday, that we can convince you that actually acidians are cool. And those of you who will want to work on acidians the next 2 weeks, it will start by going to get the acidians in the harbor. So if you want to, you can also swim a bit. Okay, so what we are very much interested in the lab is how do we generate biodiversity in nature? And there are some interesting, we're interested especially in the correlation between the way molecular information, the genome evolves, and the way the morphology evolves. And you have classical examples of correlation. I mean, you may know these cyclic fish from the Lake Malawi. Basically what happened is that you had a few isolated fish that fell in a lake that has no stream coming to it. And so they had a huge ecological niche. And within a very short geological time, they actually created a very large number of species. And these fish have a very high substitution rate in their genome. So actually, you have a correlation between the speed of molecular evolution and the speed of morphological evolution. You also have the opposite, that, I mean, maybe some of you have an idea about the opposite, something that moves very, very slowly, both at the morphological level and at the molecular level. Yeah, exactly. So the coelacanth is the opposite. I mean, it's not just the coelacanth, I think the horseshoe crab is quite similar, where you can keep the same morphology over extremely long periods of time. Actually, I think the scale is different, so they're not the same size of the fish, but they have the overall same morphology. And likewise, these genomes evolve slowly. Now, is this sort of intuitive correlation between the rates of molecular and morphological evolution a general rule? And I'm actually going to talk to you about a counterexample, something where you have the exact opposite. And these are the acidians. And so you've seen Ed's talk. So Ed was talking about this one. So this is Cyana intestinalis. But there are many. There are about 6,000 species of acidians. They're all marine creatures. And they're all fixed to a substrate. This one's edible. Maybe some of the are there Japanese people here? Yeah, okay, so Maboya. So this one you know probably. They exist in two types. So they exist as solitary animals. So this is the one I'm mostly going to talk about. This is Felusia mammillata. This is a European species. And they also exist as colonials, so that they have two life cycles. So the same genome is going actually to give rise to the same adult form via two completely different programs. One is the embryonic program, the other one is just by budding from the adult. Now, if you look, I mean, these things have a rather baroque adult body plan. So they're filter feeders. They have one inhaling siphon and the other one through which everything else comes out. But if you look at their embryos, and this is just a low-tech but quite nice movie. So these are embryos from this animal, Felusia mammillata. They are much, much more transparent than Cyana. This is one of the reasons why we're using them. And you will see, I mean, this is normally they're highly synchronous. So we fertilize them in vitro, and they're normally highly synchronous. In this case, they're not very synchronous. So this one, you see, has 4 cells. This one has 8 cells, resulting from the same lousy fertilization. But that's okay for the film. And so what you're going to see is that they seem to be pretty stereotyped. And now the film is going to accelerate. And you end up with these tiny tadpoles. So what is very nice with them is that they're very transparent. They're about 140 microns across, which is ideal to put them under a high-resolution microscope and get very nice images. Now, it's a bit bizarre that these funny-looking things would actually go through what looks for us a reasonable embryonic development, ending with a tadpole. Actually, there are acidians belong to our sister group, to the tunicates. So when people say where they belong to their sister groups, people think, oh, they're very closely related. Actually, this branching point is in the Cambrian or even earlier. So they are sister groups, yes, that explains why they have the same body plan, but they diverge a long, 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 long time ago. So if you want to know about the emergence of vertebrates, I'm not completely convinced that ascidians are the best thing to look at, because they're highly derived. Now, if one looks at their genome, so now initially the Cyna genome was sequenced a bit more, well, nearly 15 years ago. Since then, we sequenced many more ascidian genomes. And just to give you a feeling about their rate of evolution, so we sequence pairs of genomes, so two genomes from the same genus. And this is what is shown here for Fallusia and for Cyona. And this is a piece of DNA which is centered on the OTX gene, which is a transcription factor. And what you can see in green is the nucleotide conservation between the two species. And you can see that the exons are very well conserved, but you also have a lot of conservation outside of the exons. And we are also looking at transcription, and many of these are enhancers. Now, this is true between the two Fallusia species. You can find the same pattern between the Cyna species. But if you now try and compare the Fallusia and the Cyna species, the only thing that is conserved are exons from the OTX genes. You don't even find conservation of these exons, and the reason for that is because the synteny is completely disrupted, so you do not actually have the same order of the genes on the chromosome. So we're in a situation where the genome evolves incredibly quickly. Yeah?
Is the number of chromosomes the same?
No.
What are the numbers?
I think it's 14 for Cyona, and I'm not completely sure for Fallusia, it's less. But I'm not exactly sure of the number. The assemblies that we have are not at chromosome level. But of course, I mean, you can do the karyotype. I just happen not to know the precise number. Now, if you look, I mean, this is just at the nucleotide level, but if you actually look at the protein level, you find that they also diverge extremely fast within the tunicates. Now, if we look at the morphology,
can you actually put a chronological age on the divergence? If you want to use a molecular clock,
yeah.
Do you have some other metric for how when these things diverge?
We can do that. The trouble is that we have no fossils at all within this group, and so we have huge error bars. So these ones probably diverge 30 to 70 million years ago. These ones a bit less. And then if you look at the origin of the group by comparing two very divergent species, it's 350 to 550 million years.
That's molecular clock.
That's sort of calibrated molecular clocks, but that's, yeah. So I'm not sure how trustworthy these things are. So that's the genomic side. Now, if we look at the morphological side, these things seem to be, at the adult stage, very different. But actually, what is very different is the tunic. So the tunic is made of cellulose. And this is a very thick tunic, and all these things are actually acellular. So if you extract the animal from inside the tunic, they're actually pretty similar. But if you look at the embryos, it's even more striking. So these animals develop with a fixed cell lineage, very much like a C. elegans embryo. So you have a fixed cell lineage. But if you compare the lineage from these different embryos of very divergent species, it's actually virtually the same cell lineage, the same early cell lineage. And this is something that is quite unusual. If you look at the nematodes have, most of them have fixed cell lineages, but in different groups, you're going to have different cell lineages. And also, you're going to have some nematodes, marine parasitic nematodes, that actually do not have a fixed lineage. So the fact that you keep the same cell lineage over nearly 500 million years of divergent evolution is something that is very unusual. Now, how come? How come that you actually have this morphological stasis at the embryonic level, and yet that you have this very extensive genomic divergence? And I hope to convince you by the end that this may not be a paradox, but there may be some sort of causal relationship between the two. So to do that, I'm going to delve into the morphogenesis and imaging of ascidian morphogenesis. So about 10 years ago, we started reconstructing cell by cell embryos. At the time, we did it by hand. So one cell takes about 30 minutes to reconstruct. So basically, we were drawing around the cells. And we reconstructed these embryos up to the early gastrula stage. Now, that takes an awfully long time. One cell is about 30 minutes. So this thing is about 50 to 70 hours. And if we wanted to reconstruct one single embryo, it would take us many years. So we needed to somehow... we found that it was actually useful to understand individual aspects of the developmental program, and I'll come back to that later on. The throughput was just insufficient to explore a complete developmental program, insufficient to explore intraspecies variability. So Jirong's talk yesterday highlighted some of the aspects of intraspecific variability within the nematode, but also insufficient to explore interspecies divergence. So how much divergence do you actually have, even if you have a similar lineage? So we needed an automated pipeline, and for that, the first thing was to pool the expertise of different people. And so what I'm going to talk about is actually the work of four different labs. So besides my labs, there was the lab of Christophe Godin, in Montpellier as well, on image processing, some input from Grégoire Malanda, and all the imaging was done on Lars's machine. I guess you're going to hear a lot more about light sheet imaging when Lars speaks. Now, the work that I'm going to talk about was carried out by two people who are actually in the audience. They're here, over there. So they are the two TAs for next 2 weeks' module. Ula, who's the biologist, so she did all the imaging and also brought her knowledge of embryology to the project, and Leo, who's a computer scientist, and both of them have now left the lab, but this is their work that I'm going to present. So the first thing is, when we did the initial reconstruction of the embryos, we were using two-photon imaging. And two-photon imaging at that time was very slow. That was one trouble. And the other trouble is that the axial resolution is much lower than the planar resolution. And that created a big issue. So we switched to light sheet imaging in collaboration with Lars. And the reason why we use light sheet is, first of all, it's much faster than two-photon imaging. And these embryos do not need actually two-photon. They're actually quite transparent. And the second thing is that you can rotate your sample. And by rotating your sample, you can get an isotropic image that will have the same resolution in the various angles. And so this is what is highlighted here. This is one Fallusia embryo whose membranes were marked. And what you can see is that here you should have had a membrane, but you actually can't see it. Now, if you combine different views, fuse the views, now you recover the membrane. And so this is really crucial for what I'm going to show to work. Now, we generated this data set, and I'm going to talk to you about one embryo, which is the best embryo we got so far. Now, we have a few more that are being segmented, but this is all what I'm going to tell you is based on one embryo, so this is a word of caution. Also, it's not that easy to actually image many, many embryos with this technology, because you can image just one embryo at a time. And if it doesn't develop exactly the way you want, then you have to start again, etc. So we imaged this embryo every 2 minutes. The embryo was labeled with a PhGFP, so you actually can see the membranes of the embryo. And we imaged it from 64 cell stage up to something which is about 700 cells when the tail bud starts to elongate. Now, the reason why this stopped here is because the microscope updated Windows. So if you have a microscope, disconnect it from the web when you're imaging so that you don't have this sort of issue. It's very frustrating that your best embryo stops because of Windows. So now, just to show you, give you a feeling about the quality of the images. So this is now a section which is across the embryo. And if I manage to see my mouse again. Okay, so that's, you're going to see the, basically the...
This is a stable transgenic line?
No, this is not, this is microinjection of RNA. for PHGFP. So we don't really have transgenic line. It's not easy. It's not difficult to generate them, but the trouble is to have the infrastructure to culture the animals and to keep the line. That's the new relation that actually Ed was talking about. Okay, so we have this data set. Now, one of the issue is that this is absolutely huge. So this is initially 2 to 5 terabytes. So we need to extract the information from this very complex data set. And the way we do that is by identifying the cells and then reconstructing extra, basically doing automatically what we were doing manually. And the way what we use is what is called 3D seeded watershed. This is a rather classical approach to segment. And the idea is, if just to show you on this 2D image, is if you cut this image this way, you're going to see peaks of intensities and then troughs and sinks. And so basically what the program does is to find regions that have very low intensity, make seeds there, and then grow the seeds until they flow in the next cell. And this is how they identify the cells. And so this is exemplified here. So you first get your seeds, 3D, and then you grow your seeds until basically they touch each other. And then you've resegmented your embryo. So this is a very classical approach. There is nothing new there in this 3D watershed. Now, what we do afterwards is, so we start with our stacks of images. Classically, what people do is that they segment individually each of the embryos. And then once they have the segmentation, they're actually going to say, well, this cell is equivalent to this cell. So they're actually going to track the lineage after segmentation. And this is what we're saying. Now, when we do that on our data set, what we get in terms of cell lineages is this. So about 95% of cells at each time are accurately segmented. That looks very good. But the errors are actually completely at random. So from one stage to the next, it will not be the same cells that are wrong. If you now are just trying to build your tree by going from one cell at one time of segmentation to the next, you're basically accumulating all these rare events of errors, and you end up with a tree that is actually very bad. I'll come back. Just I finish my sentence, and then I'll come back. And one example here, for example, is that in these animals, you do not have any cell death, unlike C. elegans, during the embryonic period. So all your cell lineages should actually go to the end. So whenever you have a cell lineage that stops somewhere, it means the lineage is wrong. And so when we do that, virtually none of the cell lineage trees are right. Yeah, Elvi?
I was wondering, coming back to the seeds, why, I mean, people also use just the nuclei, like some nuclei that avoids, that should avoid.
No, it does not, because when you have mitosis, your nuclear membrane disappears, and you have funny things.
It's even more complicated?
I don't know if it's more complicated, but it's not more simple. And when you do that, so what, in theory, if it was much easier with the nuclei, we could label both the nuclei and the membranes and use the nuclei as seeds to recover the membranes. But, yeah, you will see later that actually we don't need the nuclei, and we found a way around that. Yeah?
So are the segmentation errors really uncorrelated from time slice to time slice?
They're not really uncorrelated, but they are quite uncorrelated. No, you do have some errors that are propagated, but you have some that just emerge for a few time points, and then they disappear, and etc. So, because we are imaging at very close time points, then we reason that actually between two time points, the embryo hasn't changed much in its topology. The cells have not changed much, apart from the few cells that might have divided between two consecutive time points separated by 2 minutes. So what we're doing is we're actually propagating the segmentation from one time point to the next. So what we do is we actually take the first time point, we manually expertise. We take this segmentation, we slightly erode the cells, we deform them with a deformation field so as to project them onto the next time point, and we use these eroded cells as seeds to resegment the next time point. And then very locally, we are looking whether there has been a cell division or not. And so this procedure, which we call ASTEC, it's not written here, is actually allows to avoid most of the errors that we get through the classical building of the tree. And the other thing that we do is that we introduce some biological a priori. And a very simple one is just that a cell, when it divides, should not divide into more than two cells. And that's very simple biological a priori. That's actually quite useful one. Now, when we...
Isn't there another that the volume of a cell should not change significantly over time?
No, we don't introduce that, but you will see that this is what happens.
From one time point to the next, you see large volume changes.
No, we do not. But we did not include it as biological a priori. This is actually what we find during the validation step. And so now, this tree that I showed earlier, using this new one-pass algorithm, this is the tree that you get. These are not the same cells, actually. It's not the same order, so don't compare cell to cell. But what we get now is that all the trees, with very, very rare exceptions, there is one here, actually go to the very end. And also, you will see what we do to validate that this is a proper segmentation. So just to give you some numbers, so number of time points analyzed is 180. What we call the cell snapshot, which is a cell at one given time. So we reconstruct about 60,000 cells, which are actually 1,300 cells. We have 671 cell divisions, and that would take quite a bit to do it manually. Just to give you an idea, how long does it take? It takes about 2 weeks of computational time, and there is no manual intervention beyond the correction of the first time point. Now, how does it look like? So just to show you this, I would call a virtual embryo now, or a digital embryo. So what you see, this is the starting point. This is the 64-cell stage. And here we've colored the cells according to their fate. So in blue, you have the notochord. Here, this is the endoderm. These are some muscle cells, etc. And this is what we get. And so this is without any manual correction. So this is the neural plate. You can see that, you have these gray lines. So these gray lines is just for visualization. Bear in mind that our collaborating lab is called Virtual Plants. So the plant people like cell walls. And initially, so I think that's the reason why it is so thick. Could have been a bit thinner, but this is just for visualization purposes. Of course, the actual data are computed on cells that are not eroded and do not have these things.
How do you know, how does the computer know to which fate to associate each cell?
Of course, this initially is done manually, based on previous published data.
Okay. Like, if you know that from the beginning you start with some part, and just following the divisions allows
exactly.
You to assign.
Okay. Well, basically here what's happening is that initially, nearly all the cells at the 64-cell stage have a given fate. Some are undetermined, but then the determination is at the next cell division, and so we implemented that manually, actually. So this is the one of the issues that we have, that we still have, and maybe some of you have ideas, is how to name the cells, because the initial nomenclature of the cell works extremely well until the early gastrula stage. But then, so this was designed in 1905 by Conklin. But then it becomes completely unreliable. So if anyone has an idea how to name cells in a lineage, you're welcome.
The number that you're currently goes up to what? 110?
The final is 709.
No, Conklin nomenclature.
The Conklin nomenclature, in theory, goes to the end.
Okay,
but the trouble is that the reference point is the vegetal pole, which is the one that invaginates. So as soon as it starts invaginating, basically you lose your reference point, and the nomenclature becomes completely unreliable.
So it's reliable until when?
112, yeah, or slightly after. So until the beginning of the gastrulation. So how good is the segmentation? Well, the first thing is just to try and do manual correction of 2D slices. And so we did that for about 17,000 cell snapshots. And what we find is that 98% of cells have less than 5% of misallocated box cells. So it's actually highly accurate segmentation. What we can do as well is try to look at the volume consistency. So when a cell divides, that's exactly what you were asking, is the sum of the volumes of the daughters equals to the volume of their mother? And this is what we get. So this is 5% difference in the volumes here. And so you see that most of the cells are actually very consistently, they have the same volume.
There's no growth, not so much.
I'll come back to that. So now the other thing that we can do is these embryos have a bilateral symmetry. And so you can compare the volumes of the two equivalent cells on either side. And when you do that, you find that the volumes are very highly correlated at the two sides. Now, next thing is exactly what you were asking, is what's happening during the cell cycle of a cell. And so what we do is we actually do the ratio of the volume at the time the cell will divide, so at the end of its life, over the volume when it is born. And when we do that, we find that the volume is actually 1, so there is no growth of the cells during the cell cycle. It's true for most cell lineages, but it's not. You can see here that you have something, and this is the epidermis. And so the epidermis slightly decreases its volume during the cell cycle. We have no idea why. It doesn't seem to be an artifact, seems to be true, but this is the kind of thing that you discover and you don't know what to do with. Yeah?
But the whole thing preserves volume or not?
I'm coming to that. Here. And so this is the volume of the whole thing. So what you have here is the time in minutes. So here is the cell number. So you see that you have actually plateaus and then cell divisions and then plateaus again. These waves, it's half of the cells are epidermis, and the epidermis tends to divide all at the same time. And so that's what creates these waves here. At the end, we are about 700 cells. If you now look at the volume, this is the volume of the total embryo, and this is basically constant. It actually decreases a little bit, and this decrease is due mostly to the epidermis decreasing its volume. Most of the other tissues actually keep the same volume.
Maybe fluid accumulation, interstitial fluid?
Sorry?
Interstitial fluid accumulation between cells, any accumulation?
Not that we can see. So there is no blastocele or anything like that in these embryos. Now, the other thing that we can do is to try and see how precise is our determination of the time of cell division. And for this, when a cell divides, in the interphase, it has a given shape. Then close to mitosis, it rounds up. During cytokinesis, it's going to adopt this kind of shape. And then it gives two round cells. And then again, the cells change shape. So now we can just plot the compacity or the sphericity of the cells and try to see whether we can actually detect this type of events and where they are positioned with respect to the time of cell division. And so this is what is shown here. So here, basically, what we color code is, this is the lineage tree, and we superimpose onto the lineage tree the compacity or sphericity of the cells. What you can see is that when they get close to a cell division, they actually increase their sphericity. And then once, just after the division, the cells are very round, and then they lose this round shape. Now we can plot that very precisely, and what we see is that if we get close to the cell division, we can see that initially there is an increase in the sphericity, this is this phase. Then there is a decrease, which corresponds to the onset of cytokinesis. And then just after the division, we actually have, again, two very round cells. So from that, we estimate that the average error that we have on defining the time of cell division is in the order of one time point or 2 minutes. So what can we do? So I hope that I've convinced you that the segmentation I'm going to talk to you about is of a reasonable quality. So what can we do with it? So the first thing we can do is we can take the cell lineage, and of course we can superimpose all the fates on this cell lineage. We can do that on the cell lineage, but we can also display in the embryo where each of the tissue is at each time point. So the summary is that we can now accurately segment and track cell shapes and cell behaviors across several cell divisions in living embryos. We have actually now segmented two embryos, but one which is not of such a high quality because the development was not as good as we want. We have another two embryos that we're currently segmenting, which are of high developmental quality. It takes about 2 weeks. And If you actually have UV, so multi-view SPIM images, you might be interested to contact us so that we can try the software on your data set, or give you the software so that you can try. So we are basically entering the quantitative era in terms of anatomy. So what can we deduce from that? And the first thing that we... So I'm going to focus now specifically onto self-rate specification events, not onto morphogenesis. We are also exploring morphogenesis, and some of you might actually want to explore morphogenesis in the next 2 weeks, but I'm going to focus specifically on self-rate specification events. So first of all, what can we learn from the lineage? And we have a lineage, so what we did was to actually design a metric in order to compare individual cell lineages. And what you expect is that if you take two cells that are the bilateral equivalent, they will have extremely similar cell lineages. So the distance between these two cell lineages should be very small. If you compare two cells that are not bilaterally equivalent but belong to the same cell fate, you expect that the distance between the lineages will be small. But if you compare different fates, then you may expect that the cell lineage will be more different, so that the distance between cell lineages will be higher. So we designed such a distance, and we clustered the cells according to the similarity of their cell lineages, so to the similarity of their mitotic history, if you want. And when we do that...
But not in regard to 3D position, for example.
Absolutely not. This is just based on the cell lineage. And so when we do that, what we get is that overall, there is a very good clustering of cells that have the same fate. So if you want to summarize that, what it means is that the mitotic history of the cell is a very good signature of the fate that it will acquire later in development.
So the fate here, if I understand correctly, is defined by this mitotic history, or if you like, mitotic future of the offspring of a given cell.
Okay, so the fate is defined by the literature. So here we know that, okay, let's... This basically... The colors correspond to the fates that are known. So this one, for example, large A76, is called trunk lateral cell. It has a fate.
Sorry, I misused words. But, but to the extent that different colors here, right,
yeah,
different fates,
uh-huh,
define so different internal structure.
Exactly.
Right,
so what we're comparing...
I can just use that mitotic...
Exactly.
Signature.
Exactly.
As identifier for the cell.
Exactly.
That's
exactly. Right. That's what I'm saying.
And that, of course, can be done starting with that labeled node.
Yeah, the first one. Yeah.
I can perhaps do that for its daughters and granddaughters.
You will
just
see.
Looking at
you will see. Okay. You will see. So the first thing was, in order to do what you're exactly proposing, which is what comes next, was to actually make sure first that the mitotic history was actually a signature of the final fate of the cells. Now, one thing, I was looking at Jirong's talk yesterday and looking at the C. elegans tree, I had the feeling that this was not necessarily, I mean, this is quite intuitive actually, but it was not completely clear looking at the tree that this would actually also work for C. elegans. I don't know if anyone has done this on C. elegans.
I asked him last night, he said, no, I pushed him, no. And he'll give you a counterexample for a certain cell which divides very synchronously.
Okay. That was my feeling by looking at the tree. Yeah.
But I'm very much intrigued by this, right? So right now, if I understand correctly, you define this distance sort of very metrically. You actually care about times. When,
yes. Yes.
But I can imagine a rather weaker definition. Where I don't
it's just
care,
the topology.
Just the order of the events.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't want this branch to divide before that, but if it jiggles a little bit, maybe that's not, or even if it jiggles a lot while preserving the order, maybe that's not a big deal.
Okay, so in this case, we actually do care about individual time points. So it's an editing distance. So we are basically counting the number of editions of single nodes that we need to do to go from one tree to another, and then we normalize by the number of events. This is the type of distance that we're using, asymmetric. So now that we have that, we can actually do exactly what Boris was mentioning, which is, well, can we actually now use the lineage to try and identify individual cell specification events? So if you consider that you have no cell fate specification event around this cell division, then you expect the two subtrees to be actually nearly identical. However, if you have a cell fate specification event around here, then you expect this subtree and this subtree to have different structures. And so this is what we actually, so we reuse the exact same distance now, but we use that on subtrees. And when we do that, we actually find a number of subtrees that have high distances between them. Now, the previously from the literature, there is a certain number of specification events that have actually been characterized. Now, these specification events, they could either be a classical induction, so you take a field of cells, you bring a signal, and some of these cells will actually be induced. Or they can be more C. elegans-like, which is binary fate, which is really associated to the cell division. And so what we find is that all the known specification events, with a few exceptions that are late events, so where the metric actually doesn't work very well, but I can discuss that individually if you want later, actually have a rather large division, have a rather large lineage tree distance. So what that says is that most of the cell fate specification events within this animal are actually binary fate, where you have a common precursor which somehow is instructed to give rise to two daughter cells that will have different fates. On top of that, what we find is that we have a number of white cells, so cells for which there was no known specification events, that actually turn out to be predicted to have one fate specification events because the cell lineage distance between the two daughters is actually quite high. I'm just going to give you one example, but before, where are actually these new ones, the ones that were not known before? And not very surprisingly, they are within tissues that will have cellular diversity. So for example, all these ones are neural tissue, so we expect that after the specification of the neural tissue, you're actually going to generate different types of neurons or glial cells, etc. Now, these ones are what is called mesenchyme. And so mesenchyme means more or less, we don't know what that is in general. And these ones are actually the cells that are going to generate the adult structure after metamorphosis. So these ones, you actually expect that they're going to generate different types of tissues, but you expect that this will occur after metamorphosis. Now, we're looking here at the early embryonic lineage, and we do see differences here. And I just want to highlight one example. This is actually this cell, which is called the trunk lateral cells, A76. And this cell, when we look at the distance between the sister lineages, we see that at this first division, we already have a large distance. This is why it's red. This division also has a large difference. This one also has a large difference. This one is actually because of unequal cleavage, but I'll come back to that later. Yeah?
I'm a little bit confused. So you're saying that the cell fate is not specified by cell lineage. By looking at the cell lineage alone, I cannot tell what cell fate.
No, I'm saying the opposite.
That the cell fate is determined by the cell lineage.
I'm saying that if you look at the cell lineage, you can know what is the cell fate.
Okay. And is the cell lineage invariant in ascidian?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. Like in a nematode, the difference with the nematodes is that different species of nematodes will have different cell lineages, whereas in ascidians, they all seem to be the same.
Please correct me if I say something wrong, but usually I think a cell fate specification events happen, originate from asymmetric divisions, and this is maybe.
I'll come back to that.
So, that, do you see usually asymmetric divisions also come with asymmetric volume?
I'll come to that. Okay, so in this case, this is an example where you have asymmetric divisions in terms of fate throughout the tree, But actually, this is quite interesting because these are the adult images. So we do not actually have the stem cells that keep on until nearly metamorphosis. We actually have already a specification within these adult lineages as early as the gastrula stage. This is the early gastrula stage. Now, what could be the molecular mechanisms of this fate specification? And then I'm going to Hervé's question, which is, well, what about unequal cleavages? And so coming back to this cell lineage, we can now measure the volumes of the cells, and we can just look at what are the volumes. And what we see is that, well, this one is unequal, this one's equal, this one's unequal, this one's unequal, all the others are equal. So from that, what we gather is that there is not first a perfect match between fate specification and unequal cleavage, but the unequal cleavages that we see are mostly at the place where the lineages have different structures. Now, we can actually quantify that. So we can actually now plot the sister cell volume ratios. What you see, and this is a log scale, is that most of them are actually equal, but then you have a long tail of unequal cell cleavages. And just to highlight that this is actually very nicely patterned within the embryo is just to have a look at the neural plate. And if we look at the neural plate, so this is before the neurulation that Ed was presenting yesterday. What you see is that each, so these small bars here link two cells that are sister cells. The brown cells are big, the blue cells are small. And so you can see that this geometric distribution of unequal cell cleavages within the neural plate, and the neural plate is highly patterned, each of the cells is actually going to give rise to a different fate. But this is not true everywhere. And so when we actually now plot the sister cell volume ratio versus the lineage tree distance, so that comes more to what Hervé was asking, you actually see that you have cells that are undergo specification events, but that actually have very equal cell divisions. But when you have large unequal cell divisions, it invariably is among the cells that actually undergo cell fate specification events. So we can quantify that and find that if you look at the equal divisions, most of the cells that are not expected to undergo a fate specification event divide equally, but not all of them. And vice versa, if you look at the cells where you expect the cell fate specification events according to the lineage tree distance, then the majority of them undergo an equal division. So what could be driving this, all this? Of course, some of it could be mechanically driven. I mean, if you pull on the cell, you might actually displace the spindle, and that might create an asymmetric division. But it could also be driven by cell inductions. And initially, ascidians were characterized as being animals that have a mosaic development, which is supposed that you inherit different maternal determinants and that the very precise cell cleavage will allocate the right fate to each of the cells by inheritance of these localized maternal determinants. Since then, we know that, as in C. elegans, a large part of the cell division of the cell fate specification events are actually due to local inductions. So, can we actually define these inductions? And I'm just going to come back first to the classical inductions that you have in, for example, a vertebrate embryo, but any embryo that has many cells, basically. What is thought is that you have fields of cells that are patterned by, you have a source of signal, you actually are going to have some sort of gradient of the signal with different concentrations of the ligand, and the cells will read the concentration of the ligand, and according to this concentration, they will get induced or not, or they will get induced in different fates. So that's the sort of classical French flag model that you would have. So what the cells read, basically, here, is the inducer concentration. Now, we are working with an embryo that has very, very few cells. So it's a bit complicated to imagine that the cells are actually going to read precisely concentrations, because your ligands are going to actually, you may expect them to diffuse quite freely across the embryo, and then this mechanism might actually not work very well. And indeed, when we first reconstructed the embryos, the first thing that we reconstructed 10 years ago. We used that to characterize the mechanism of one induction, which is the neural induction. So these red cells here are going to form part of the brain of the animal. Now, we know that these cells are actually induced by an FGF signal. This FGF signal is mostly secreted by these yellow cells here. But what you see is that actually these cells are induced, these ones are not, but they all touch the source. They're actually all very close to the source of signal. So how come that these cells are not induced and these ones are? And you could think that this is a difference in competence, but actually when you isolate the cells and you treat them with FGF, they show the same competence. So this is not an issue of competence, and what we could find is that what it is that the surface of contact between the cells and the inducing cells is what the embryo reads. So you have very short-range induction, and basically just what is at the interface between two cells is what is actually important for the embryo. So I presented you this model before, where the quantitative information for the induction is the concentration of ligand. What comes from these early study 10 years ago is the idea that actually in these ascidian embryos, what matters is not the concentration of inducers, it's actually the fraction of the cell surface that receives the induction. So you have, if you wish, in embryos with many cells, most of the cells may be the most of the cell surface of the most of the surface of the cell is exposed to the inducer, so the concentration of inducer is important. In these embryos with a stereotype geometry, it's actually the fraction of the cell that is exposed to the inducer which might provide the quantitative information. So can we actually now test that having the geometry of our embryos? And what we actually want to test is this juxtacrine signaling a general rule for the inductions? And for that, what I'm going to present you is a model of differential induction that we generated, where we integrate the expression pattern of all the known signaling ligands and their antagonists at any given cell, at any given time. And this was generated mostly by the lab of Yutaka Sato in Japan, with the geometries that we actually created. So we are going basically to use mass action kinetics to compute how much of the intracellular effector is going to be activated in response to these ligands, introduce some biochemical parameters and thresholds, which will be free parameters, and then we're actually going to train that onto the known inductions and see whether we actually do find parameters that match and whether these parameters have some sort of biological relevance. And then finally, and this is where it will come back to the evolution, is to see, well, how sensitive are the predictions to perturbations in the geometry of the embryo. So just to show you first how it looks like. So this is now projecting onto the reconstructed embryos the ligands that activate the FGF pathway. So this is the vegetal side, so this is going to be the endoderm here. This is at the 64 cell stage, this is the animal side. Now, FGF in these embryos is counteracted by efferine. One activates ERK via SOS, the other one represses ERK via RAS-GAP. And what you can see is that the expression patterns of these two types of ligands are actually highly complementary.
This is protein or RNA?
This is RNA. Actually, it's a mix. We don't know the protein, but we infer the presence of protein by introducing time delays from the presence of the RNA as well as decay. So it's a sort of a predicted presence of protein, but we don't have any antibodies. And what you can see from there is that between two stages, so these two stages are separated by something like half an hour, you can see how dynamic the expression patterns are actually within these embryos. Yep.
What is the earliest stage at which you see patterned expression of FGF? Do you see the 32 or 64 is the first one?
No, actually, our embryo reconstruction starts at 64. So that's why I just projected that from 64. You can actually see patterns, FGF expression from 16,
from 16
cell onwards. It's the vegetal hemisphere.
So it is zygotic and uniformly expressed, and the uniform expression comes from... So
it's not uniformly expressed. It's uniformly expressed within the vegetal plate,
okay,
not in the animal. So this is the animal side, so that will form the epidermis. This is actually not expressing FGF, even at the 16 cell stage.
There's no uniformity in half of the embryo, so where does it come from? So there is...
It's beta-catenin, which is activated on the vegetal side, which turns on FGF. It's transcriptional, No, it's not localized RNA. We don't know what creates the bias in beta-catenin. It's not localized RNA. We don't know what it is.
Understand the difference in the number of cells between these stages.
Yes, some of the vegetal cells here, these ones have not divided from this stage to this stage, whereas most of the other cells are. That's why it's not a power of two. Okay, so in order to test whether the geometry is actually sufficient to explain for the inductions, we're going to make a certain number of hypotheses. So the first hypothesis, which is actually validated by what I showed you on the lineage analysis, is that most of the cell fate specification events are binary differential induction between daughter cells. The second one is that we actually do not know the precise amount of ligand which is secreted. We don't have antibodies. We don't have any way of precisely quantifying the amount of ligand. So we're just going to say that the amount of ligand that is secreted is the same for all the pathways. And this is going to be one free parameter which we can set. We are going to hypothesize that the signaling ligands and their inhibitors do not significantly diffuse laterally, so that when a cell expresses a ligand, it's only going to affect the cells that touch it, not any cell that is further away. And then we're actually going to include the precise area of contact between cells. Now, so this is what the way we model that. So let's consider this cell A, and we're looking at the response of cell A to this red ligand that is expressed by cell B and cell C. So basically what's going to happen here is that the only ligand that matters is here. And so here you have a number of receptors. We're going to consider that the receptors are uniformly distributed around the whole cell, so that this is the surface of contact multiplied by some sort of density, which is the same for all the pathways. Then this will, in turn, activate internal effectors, which is here. Now, this is a simple case where you just have a ligand. But in many cases, we actually also have things that will inhibit the ligands. For example, if you're interested in the BMP pathway, you're going to have Cordin or Noggin that will block BMP. So when we have such a situation like here, where you have here at this interface the ligand, at this interface you have the ligand and the inhibitor, we're just going to consider that the inhibitor completely blocks the ligand, so that the only surface that is productive is this one. So basically, we're trying to simplify the system as much as we can and to avoid having too many free parameters, which of course would make a model that works, but which would not be very significant. And then what we're doing is to basically use very classical mass action kinetics.
Can I ask you a quick question?
Yeah.
So you haven't said anything yet about thresholds.
I'll come back to that.
You're going to come back.
Yeah, I'm going to come back to the thresholds, how we set the thresholds, etc.
Okay.
So basically what we have is these classical mass action kinetics plus the conservation of matter. And where we introduce the geometry is in the total number of receptors that can be activated, which is a given density of receptors multiplied by the sum of the areas of contact between the cell of interest and the cells that secrete the ligand. This is the way we introduce the geometry into the model. Now, we can actually solve that analytically, given a certain number of simplifications. And what we have in the end, so this E star is the amount of intracellular ligand that is activated within the cells in response to a given ligand. And what you see is that in this equation, you have two terms. You have one term, which is entirely the geometric contribution, the sum of all the interactions between the cell and the surrounding cells that secrete the ligand. And then another term, which includes the time, but which also includes more genetic determinants, so that's this KFLT. LT is the total amount of ligand, the concentration of ligand, and KF is the association constant between the ligand and the and its receptor.
So your level of effector eventually becomes, so just a second, so this 1 over L multiplies only the decay in terms of, so it's inversely proportional to how much ligand you have.
This, no, because you have this thing here. No, it's not.
So, but this thing will decay, right, eventually?
It will decay, but it will decay quite slowly.
Okay, so this is a decaying function of how much ligand you have, and then you have an inverse function of how much ligand you have.
So actually, when you plot that with respect to KFLT, it's actually increasing, as you will, as you might expect. Initially, I had the same sort of surprise when I came to this equation, thinking, oh, that's strange, because the more ligand you have, the less effector you have. But actually, when you plot the function, this is not what you found. It's actually the more ligand you have, the more effector you have, as you might predict. We can discuss that later if you want. Okay, so that's in the case of simple ligands. Now we have one pathway, which is a bit more complicated, which is the one that I showed you before, which is the one where you have actually FGF that turns on SOS, which turns on RAS-GTP, which will turn on ERK, and EFRIN, which turns on RAS-GAP, which blocks RAS-GTP and represses ERK. So we have two pathways that actually feed onto the same effector there. And so we modeled that as well, and we end up with the fact that RAS-GTP is actually a ratio of the amounts of SOS and RAS-GAP. So, I mean, if you're interested in, and if you have feedbacks on these equations, I'm happy to discuss that after the talk. So now, how does it look like? So, this is an example. So this is here FGF, the ligands. This is the EFRIN ligands. This is the vegetal side of the embryo. This is the animal side of the embryo. And here, this is a color-coded map of the status of ERK activation, where blue means that it is not activated, and red means that it is activated. So what you get from the model is that you can actually see that this is not exactly intuitive, which cell actually has a high ERK and which cell does not have a high ERK. You might expect, well, that's strange. I mean, this one expresses FGF. FGF acts autonomously, so this one should actually have a high ERK. Well, except that this cell is actually surrounded by EFRINs, and EFRINs block ERK. So when we integrate that, you find that actually you have a very low level of ERK, whereas these ones have a high level of ERK. So now, this is just a representation of the level of the...
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
But isn't there EFRIN right next to this high ERK?
Here you have EFRIN, and you also have ERK. But by...
But you just explained that the ERK was absent in other cells because there was EFRIN nearby.
Yes, it all depends on the various surfaces of contact between the ligands. That's why it's actually not completely trivial to find.
So is orange higher than red, or is red higher than orange?
Red is higher than orange.
Yeah. Have you shown in the way that you did in that current biology paper for FGF that other signaling pathways are also dependent on surface area contact?
No.
Okay.
No. We don't know for the others. Of course, so what I should have said is that in these early embryos, basically we have five signaling pathways that are active. BMP, nodal, notch, WNT, FGF, EFRIN. So notch, you actually expect it to be cell autonomous. I mean, not cell autonomous, but just a kind. BMP, WNT, that's not key. So now, this is a representation which is very visual, but which actually does not allow to really look at the cells. So let's switch to a different one. And the different representation is that here, at a given stage, we're going to link the two daughter cells and plot in these two daughter cells the level of the activation of the pathway. And we're going to do that for individual pathways. So we are not considering crosstalk between pathways here. So this is now looking at ERK stage 8. And what you see is that, well, you have daughter cells that seem to have quite different, sister cells that seem to have quite different level of signaling, which might be what we're looking for. But you have them here. You also have them here. So where is the threshold for which you have an induction? Is the threshold here? Is the threshold here? What is induced? What is not induced? What is meaningful for the embryo? What is not meaningful for the embryo? And so to try and sort that out, what we do is we're going to consider, we're going to plot the cumulative distribution of the values of the effector in the cells at all stages. And we're going to set a threshold, which we call tau, which is going to say, well, if your cells are in the 40% of cells that receive the least amount of signal, we're going to consider this is not an induction. And this will be a free parameter. Now, the beauty of this thing is that tau is the same for all the pathways. But because the distribution of signalings are different, this translates into a threshold of activator activation, which is different for each pathway. So a single parameter is actually able to give you thresholds that differ in the different pathways via the cumulative distribution.
What is the basis for making that assumption, though? It's
a sort of an intuitive. We were looking for something that would say, well, not all cells can be induced. Let's consider that just a certain fraction of the cells can be induced. Let's try and make it simple. Now, let's make that a free parameter. And then we're going to train and try to see whether that works or not. So when we do that, now we have this threshold parameter. And we can say, OK, so below this threshold, we know this is not going to be induced. So these ones we are not going to consider at all. Now, what about these ones? Now, we're looking for differential equation, for differential induction. So the first thing we're going to set now is a different free parameter, which is rho, which is going to be the ratio of the level of activators within the between the sister cells. Because we're looking for differential induction, so we're going to say, well, we're going to look for cells that, for example, have 1.8 times more effector in one daughter rather than the other. So this is highlighted in green now. So these are the events that we're going to consider only. Now, this is odd, because we're considering that all the cells have the same competence to respond. If you look at these two cells, at these two couples of cells, this cell should be induced, this one not. This cell should be induced, this one not. So there is an incoherence in the system, because this one actually receives less signal than this one, and it should actually be induced according to that. So this is incoherent. So we are going basically to look at the highest level of an uninduced cell, and we're going to say, well, any cell that is below this cannot be induced.
I mean, in particular, in the case of Notch, that is really not what happened, right? Because what cells are doing is to perform a mutual induction, which is a game of comparing the relative levels of the two cells, so the ratio and not really the absolute amount of signal. At least in those.
Yeah. So this is, I agree, what we're really doing here is doing many simplifications. What we're really after is trying to see whether the geometry of the embryo provides sufficient encoding to have the various inductions. So now we have this threshold. Any cell below that, we're going to consider it cannot be induced. Now we can do the same thing for the other one. So this one here, this one is induced according to this model. So any cell that is above this one should actually be induced. And so by doing that, we are going to end up with this model where basically all the yellow cells and green cells are induced. All these ones are not induced. And you have these two thresholds that are going to be stage-specific and pathway-specific for saying whether you have an induction or not. And from that, what you get is that these are the differentially induced cells predicted from the model. So now, I showed you all these values are actually with a given set of parameters, which is not completely chosen at random. It's actually a good set of parameters that we find. But how do we get to this good set of parameters? And so what we do is actually we now take the ground truth of 14 known inductive events in different pathways, and we are now going to look for the parameters in terms of induction time, of this KFLT, of rho, tau, and delta, which is something I didn't explain. And we're going to try and see where can we actually find thresholds that are going to work in a nice way. And the answer is yes. So here is now, here are the parameters. I'll come back to the parameters after. So what you see here is the daughter's distance score. So this is actually the lineage distance between the daughters. So you expect that the ones that are with a high value are going to be predominantly induced compared to the ones that have a very low value. Now you also have a color code. The blue cells are the cells where we do not expect any induction. For example, this is the epidermis, some of the epidermis. The orange, the magenta cells are the cells for which we know that there are inductions. And then the brown cells are cells for which we have indications that something might be happening there, but we're not quite sure what is happening. What you can see is that if you look at the blue cells first, the uninduced cells, well, most of them do not show any differential induction. And this here, this axis, the distance here has no meaning. It's just to spread out the points here and here. So most of the uninduced cells are actually predicted not to be induced. If you look at the magenta cells, most of the magenta cells are actually predicted to be induced. And in most cases, they're predicted to be induced by the right pathway. So it's not just that they are predicted to be induced, they're actually predicted to be induced by the right pathway. And the pathways that induce them, they're not the five pathways. They're actually one or two pathways. And if we quantify that, we find that the uninduced cells, most of them are predicted not to be induced. The known inductions, most of them are predicted to be induced using the proper pathway. And then the ones that are the brown ones, actually this is a mixed bag. About half of them are predicted to be induced, half of them are not predicted to be induced, so in which case either this is a pathway that we haven't mapped, or this might be intrinsic asymmetric divisions, for example, due to mechanical constraints that lead to a fate specification event, something like that. Okay, so what we conclude from that is that with all the simplifications that we actually built into the model, but reducing as much as possible the number of free parameters, we conclude that the geometry of the embryo has a sufficient encoding power to actually provide the information for induction within these embryos. Now, yeah?
Is y-axis on this bar graph percent or numbers?
Numbers. These are numbers. Yeah, sorry. Should have had it. Okay, so now let's go back to the initial question, which is how does that actually relate to evolution? And the idea, if the encoding power is mostly in the geometry, you might expect that if the geometry was not strongly constrained, then you would lose many of the fate specification events. And the reason why you have such a nice morphological stasis might be precisely to preserve these inductions. So to test that, what we do is actually now to introduce noise in the geometry of the embryo and see how does that affect the prediction of inductions. And so the way we actually introduce the noise, so I told you that the amount of effector inside the cell has two terms, one which is mostly genetic and time, and the other one, which is purely the geometrical contribution. So what we're now doing is we're going to take each of the surface of interaction between two cells, and we are going to randomly add or subtract a maximum of X percent of this area. So we are going, and now in order to do that in a sort of half clever way, we're going to impose that the variation is the same on the left and the right cell interfaces to preserve the bilaterality. And we're also going to say that between successive time points, this percentage of change in the surface is preserved. We are not preserving the total surface of the cell. So this constraint we do not have in this noise. But as you can see, so this is now the percentage of specification event failure that we have. So, and we have the three classes, the over predictions. So this is a cell that should not be induced and which the model predicts to be induced. Now, if you introduce noise there, basically there is no change. These are the blue points. Whatever the noise, the amount of noise that you actually increase. So this is actually quite stable. Now we have two others. One is the missed cell inductions. So we say, well, this cell is induced and we don't find it induced, no matter which pathway it is. This one, we missed very, very few in the real geometry. And as soon as we start adding a bit of noise, even 10% of noise in the surfaces, actually we multiply the error by 3. So this is something that is very sensitive to the geometry. And now if we look at the pairs of this cell is induced, and it's induced by this ligand, and this is the red curve, we see also that adding 10 or 20% of noise to the surfaces is enough to vastly increase the number of missed pairs of ligand and signal. So from that, the conclusion is actually that the geometry has to be very precisely set in these embryos so that you have the right specification events. So I'm coming to the end. The thing that I didn't tell you is what are these parameters? So these parameters, so this says that in order to have an induction, the low threshold means that we are considering that 44% of the cell interactions are not productive. So the ones that are the lowest one, the lowest 44% are not productive. Rho is 1.6. It means that the difference in signaling between the two daughter cells should be 1.6 times. And that's about what we found in the neural induction study. KFLT is the association constant of the ligand multiplied by the concentration of ligand. If you scan the literature for that, you find that it should be in the ballpark of 10 to the minus 4 second minus 1. And this is, we find that it is, the optimal value is 210 to the minus 5. So it's, again, the same the right ballpark. The time needed for an induction here is 10 minutes. And what was characterized in a different acidian for an induction was 10 minutes. So that, again, we're in the right ballpark. And this delta I won't go into. This is something to counterbalance Efrin, which about has the right value as well. Yeah.
How would you assess now experimentally the sensitivity of to geometrical noise predicted by noise?
So maybe we can do that just after I finish, and then we come back to your question, because maybe there will be indications there before in the last few slides. Okay. So what I hope to have convinced you that actually this differential surface contact has a sufficient encoding power to actually code for the inductions within this animal. Now, okay. So what I think I hope to have said is that, first of all, to convince you that we can reconstruct and quantify the behavior of each cell in a caudate embryo with a 2 minutes time resolution over 5 cell divisions, in this case 6 hours, that if you analyze the cell lineage tree architecture, you can actually systematically identify cell fate specification events, and that these fate specification events are mostly binary events associated to cell divisions, that you do have a preferential association of unequal cell cleavages with cell fate specification events, but it's not a perfect correlation, and that the areas of contact between inducing and competent cells have this sufficient encoding potential to account for most inductions. And finally, that the geometry is probably strongly constrained, in part because of this mechanism being used to specify the different fates. Now, how can we actually look at that? So one thing is just to sample variability. So how much variability do you actually have within a given species? So you would expect that the cells that talk to one another will have more constrained surface of contact than the ones that do not talk to one another. For example, at least this is something that is interesting to test. Maybe it's not what we're going to find, but this is the kind of thing that we actually would like to go to. Is there any sort of structure in the variability, both spatial but also temporal? I mean, some of you might have heard of this hourglass thing. Do we actually find an hourglass type of pattern? Now, there is another species, which is actually the species we're going to work with in the next 2 weeks, which is called Acidiella aspersa, which also has very nice transparent embryos, and which fortunately grows in this country. So we imported that from Woods Hole. And so we're going to compare Fallusia and Acidiella and see what do you actually find. Is the model working the same way, basically, in different species? Okay, and I think I will just stop here. I'm not going to mention again the people, but the two people are here. Discussing how bad a job I did on their work. and you will have plenty of occasions to interact with them. So Leo did all the computational work. It seems that this is a lot of computational work and very little biology, but you will see that getting these embryos, imaging them in the proper way, getting all what is needed, actually doing the manual corrections and the manual tests of all the reconstructions was a lot of work by Ulla, who also worked on gastrulation. So if you're interested in gastrulation, ask her about gastrulation. And this was funded by these people, and this is a nice picture of islet of a smiley Acidian. And I thank you for your attention. Yeah?
Would you be able, simple, maybe stupid idea, be able to just compress the embryo to see maybe that would
So what we did initially in the neural induction study, what we did was to half the embryo, because when you half the embryo, it's harsh, but we halved it in two directions. So we halved the embryo and the cells established new contacts, and we could actually see that when the cells establish new contacts, they get induced according to the surface of contact. This is what convinced us that the surface of contact was not just a correlation.
Does the embryo survive?
The embryo will survive everything. Of course, it won't make a tadpole, but it will survive. Yeah. And if you compress it as well.
Maybe ablate a cell locally, or...
You can do that. You can do this kind of experiments, yeah. Yeah. Stas?
So, invertebrate embryos, the induction time windows are typically longer.
Yeah.
Why do you think that happens? Because we're using the same molecules and...
this is actually a whole bunch of questions related to that.
Yeah.
So you could imagine, for example, here that the reason why the ligand does not diffuse is because the embryo is raised through development, and so the actual ligand does not have the time to diffuse. You could imagine that because, for example, the extracellular matrix is different or whatever, or because of the property of the ligand itself. So why do we actually see that FGF just acts on the cell that is just right next to it and not further away? It's supposed to diffuse FGF. It does not in these embryos.
But once you are inside the cell, right, you're presumably using the same sources and gaps and ergs. That are all highly conserved, right? So once you have already received enough ligand receptor complexes and you're making a decision, why do your embryo take 10 minutes?
How long does it take in a vertebrate embryo or in a Drosophila embryo to actually turn on ERK in response to an extracellular signal?
Minutes.
Yeah, exactly. So it's the same here.
But so what I meant is not to turn ERK. What I meant is to make a decision to commit to a lineage that would be irreversible. So
this is now looking actually not at ERK, but looking at how ERK is interpreted and integrated at the level of transcription.
Yes.
And this we know very little about. So this is really something that we really need to quantify. What is happening there exactly? How does that interfere with the transcription factors? Is the phosphorylation of ETS, for example, we know ETS is downstream of this thing, something that is stable versus unstable in vertebrate embryos, for example? These are things that we have no idea in quantitative terms.
Is it possible to swap molecularly some things between, let's say, to take a vertebrate ETS?
In theory, it is possible with CRISPR. So CRISPR-Cas9 works in these animals. Getting the lines is not easy, but it actually works pretty well in F0. But for the replacement, I'm not sure. For deletion, it works very well in F0.
How different in timing are these events, for example, to watching a zebrafish go through its induction in the first
time? Zebrafish races through development.
Yeah.
Also.
Typically.
Yeah. I agree.
So from the time that the cell gets a dose of FGF and turns on, does P6 or whatever, so what are the typical times in fish? P3 or whatever the fish turned on.
Have people treated cells with FGF and looked at ERK, phospho-ERK? In a careful way with timing and so on?
Quite possibly. I'm thinking about things like when you see the DUSP6 promoter-driven GFP, I'm trying to remember whether I know how quickly that gene comes on in a new cell line, but I think it's tens of minutes or something. I don't know. You have to go look at
it. It's in the minute range for nodal. Yeah, okay. Yeah.
Responses to Notch are in minutes to 10 minutes.
So the reason I'm asking, I'm thinking whether somehow these very rapidly developing embryos, like insects and ascidians, came up with a way to accelerate signal transmission through exactly the same pathways that are used by slower developing mice.
So you have to be careful when you say these fast developing embryos. Fallusia and Cyana develop fast. Hallucintia, which is the Japanese one, develops much slower, and it develops at 9 degrees.
9 degrees?
Yeah.
But if you saw that
Celsius.
But if you use an Arrhenius factor, that's a chance.
Yeah, it could be.
There are insects that won't scale. Cicadas will never scale.
Yeah.
Also, the size are very different, right?
And also, that's the other thing that is quite fascinating. But it's more fascinating if you're interested in mechanics, I think, which is that the size of the embryos, some of these embryos are 1 millimeter across, some of the colonial ones. And they have the same cell lineage. And presumably, no one has really looked at the fate specification events, but presumably there are similar fate specification events. So you have, they're able to scale different sizes. And if you consider in terms of mechanics of doing the same morphogenetic movements, and something is a cortical property versus a volume property, and you have scaling, this is, whoa, how do they do that? Yeah?
I have two questions, and I guess I'm related. So you told us definitely that by curating manually, you found that the precision of tracking cells was very, very
impossible.
I'm not sure if you said whether the precision to track membranes.
These are membranes.
Sure, but what I understood is that you are good at knowing that cell is that cell.
No.
So you're talking
91% of the cells have less than 1% of box cells that are in the wrong cell.
Okay.
And 98% have less than 5% of box cells.
But then, what you said is that you need to explore the variability and
So we actually looked at variability between left-right. It's n equals 2, so that's why I didn't really show that. What we conclude from that is that there can be strange orientations between left and right. We have two cases of cells that orient do not divide in the same orientation between left and right. If we look at the timing of the cell divisions between left and right, which is more interesting, we actually see quite a bit of variability, up to 15-20 minutes.
So you have a left-right asymmetry?
So we, at these times, we're not supposed to have left-right asymmetry. So we can actually use left and right as two independent embryos, if you wish. I mean, that's what Marcus is suggesting.
Yeah, I guess the difference of 15 minutes is massive.
It's massive. Yeah. It's massive in the late
that
stages.
What happened with your...
The model does not go until the end of the film. The model actually goes until the end of mid-gastrilla, because after that, we do not have the atlas of gene expression. So at these early stages, the timing seems to be pretty consistent between the two sites. And then the errors accumulate. So that's why you get increasingly differences. So there doesn't seem to be an obvious mechanism to constrain the error so that they would stay the same throughout development. Like what Jérôme was showing in C. elegans, it seems that the timing of cell division is very, very similar. It seems in our case that it can be quite different.
So I think from the algorithm that we had was more like it was an internal clock that would drive division, at least for the epidermis. As soon as a cell would divide a bit later, then the daughter will divide also later compared to the other one. But then if you look at the length of the set cycle, it would be pretty conserved.
Yeah. So basically you accumulate the errors.
But if you
have no compensation.
That means that then the noise in expression patterns with time in the embryo would also be bigger and bigger and bigger.
It could be, yeah. We don't know that. I mean, in terms of gene expression level, we are actually not quantitative at all. So we actually would need to be quantitative to address this type of questions.
More questions? All right. Thank you very much, Patrick.
Thank you.